Hello and welcome to the ORI Spotlight Podcast. We're talking to leaders across the cell and gene therapy industry and telling you more about ORI's mission to manufacture brighter futures. I'm Jason Foster, the CEO of ORI Biotech, and I'll be your host for today's podcast. Hello and welcome to the ORI Spotlight Podcast. This is Jason Foster. I'll be your host today. Along with me, I am surrounded by chief digital officers. I've got Elliot Menchik from National Resilience, who's the chief digital officer there, as well as ORI's own Kevin Gordon. Thank you both for joining me. Welcome, Elliot and Kevin.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for the invite to be here.
Absolutely. Elliot, if you don't mind, I'd love to start with you. Looking back at your history, you've got extensive experience as a founder and healthcare data as a VC before your time at AWS and now at Resilience. I'd love to learn a little bit more about kind of the red thread going through that experience and how you're kind of bringing all those pieces together at Resilience today.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's been a pretty unplanned meandering path. I trained as an electrical engineer as an undergraduate. For no good reason, went to medical school and did a doctor in neuroscience while I was there, and discovered as I came back into the second half of med school in the clinics, going through rotations, that I was much more interested in solving the problems like an engineer would than perhaps being a physician, and was attracted to a number of issues and how we took care of patients and how data and information was used or not used effectively at the time. And so I wound up starting a company rather than continuing on as a practicing physician. That sort of led me into startup land for where I've pretty much been my entire career. So I have spent time starting, building, running a number of healthcare startups, investing in them as well as a seed stage VC. And then my only detour into corporate life was at AWS, the cloud computing arm of Amazon, where I was recruited to start sort of the practice that looked after the healthcare and life science startup ecosystem. So all the investors and the companies that they back, and what could Amazon do on their behalf to help them in any way possible. And there had been a sort of startup team there, and there has been for a number of years, really focused on who's the next, you know, Netflix, Airbnb, you know, Pinterest, Stripe, et cetera. But it had never been industry specific. And as you can imagine, biotech, medtech, health tech, they have their own unique flavors. And so I led the effort to sort of build a global team around that. And that kind of grew into other industries as well beyond healthcare and life sciences. And then I was approached by one of the early investors in Resilience when it was sort of still in stealth mode, and basically asked, hey, would you like to go build the AWS of biomanufacturing? And got into it. It became a pretty compelling thing. It was going to be a once in a lifetime effort. So, I left a little bit sad and bittersweet, but been here for the last 18 months or so.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, I think the work that you and your team are doing at Resilience and really forward looking how the industry needs to evolve, playing on a lot of that background, has been really inspiring for companies like ours as well. I wanted to just welcome Kevin to just very briefly give his intro as well, having done some of the similar things that you've done. I've got kind of two experts here that we can pick your brains for the rest of the hour. So Kevin, go ahead.
Sure, thank you. So really spent an entire career working in the life sciences industry. And as I sort of navigated through there, sounds somewhat similar to Elliot as far as not much of a red thread, just bounced between opportunities, did bump into Kite Therapeutics very early on in their development as they were just working to solve the cold chain logistics and sort of vein to vein chain of custody tracking, tracing challenges, and really focused in there and had an opportunity to bounce through a number of those companies, wrapping up at Atara Therapeutics and an allogeneic platform. And as I continue to evolve there, bumped into Bruce Levine and Carl June out of Penn, who introduced me to Azazam, who at that point was taking the intellectual property back out of Novartis that was generated from Penn University and founding Teamunity. And in 3 years at Teamunity, built a fully paperless manufacturing system, including a laboratory information management LIMS and a paperless certificate of analysis, and that sort of capstoned into a meeting with the FDA for our type C, where not only did they support everything we were doing, but literally said to us that we could run multiple lines of therapy in the same clean ballroom, where if we didn't have such digital and granular control over our custody identity, they would have asked us to wash, clean, retool, recalibrate to be able to switch cars in that facility. And as time progressed, got to know Jason and the Ori team and was very happy to join in sort of more of the heart of manufacturing in the space.
Awesome. Thanks, Kev. Elliot, as you know, we had Rahul Singhvi, your CEO, on the podcast not that long ago, a couple months ago, maybe 6 months ago. We were interested in having you on really to discuss the kind of the digital angle of what you're doing at Resilience in helping to usher in a new era of biomanufacturing as a service. And we'd love to hear about that in more detail and your strategies as you think about the business. I might, for ease, use the word, the initial CDMO at some point today erroneously, knowing that really Resilience does a lot more than that. But, you know, it's not often that people who are going to be servicing therapeutics developers in this way are thinking so far ahead and really thinking proactively about digital. So I'd love to know how that came about and how you're thinking about it inside the organization.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the thesis of the company even before I joined when it was just getting started, from the founding with Bob Nelson and Pat Yang to hiring Rahul. And then ultimately recruiting, it was always to be a digital first company because the notion was that there are a ton of bottlenecks, errors, costs, just pain in this industry tied up in things that are bespoke and manual, error prone. If you're going to be investing in what the future manufacturing is, then digital automation has to be a big part of that. And so part of the benefit of being a new company is to try and do it a different way based on, you know, the mistakes that have been seen in the past and sort of successes you've seen in flashes of inspiration in various other places. And so that was always a part of what Resilience was going to be, which is why, you know, they went hunting for folks to join that were not, we were coming from tech, not from biotech, in the sense that, you know, we can be taught, well, at least we think we can be taught. And so the whole notion of digital here is really two sides of one coin, which is a different customer experience. At the end of the day, we exist to serve our partners and help them manufacture and not have to invest and do sort of this very heavy lift of everything involved in industrializing recipes and making them at scale. And so we expect there to be a different kind of experience for those partners and how they interact with us in an electronic way, that there's visibility, there's predictability, there's confidence that they can get to market faster, and they get leverage from a partner like us. So you need sort of a digital interface to the customer for that to happen. And on the flip side, it's all about the performance of facilities, whether those are laboratories or our factories. How are we going to drive down errors, which are typically rampant? How are we going to scale our ability to serve more customers with the same footprint and do so in a much higher quality way and more reliable way? So all that requires investment in digital.
Yeah. And how does it manifest itself as a benefit for, let's say, maybe an earlier stage therapeutics company in the development stages? And then ultimately through commercialization, what are those kind of tangible time, cost, and quality kind of benefits that your customers would expect to realize from this investment? Because we wholly agree with you that this is actually a foundational element moving forward, particularly for cell and gene therapy, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But I wonder how a customer might feel the differences of what you guys are proposing to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's still super early days, but some of the early success is just, how do you give a customer a place to log in, see the work that is being done, collaborate asynchronously in real time with the team, be able to see the progress against the project and its milestones, how are raw materials being consumed, how are things tracking against the cost of the project, how are things going in terms of developing what the CPPs or CQAs are. How do you transact just documents electronically back and forth, the artifacts between the teams that are working to, you know, industrialize a process, a bioprocess, a recipe? And then as that moves into a facility, you know, what the customer can see from raw material to finished product as it's happening, as we're, you know, brewing their product, if you will, within the, you know, bioreactors in the facility. So, you know, at a minimum, we expect, you know, a higher degree of confidence, a higher degree of trust between the teams that are working together, you know, just, you know, faster time to market in terms of the ability to transact electronically instead of, you know, through manual means. But, you know, we're starting to measure what those tangible improvements are, but it's too early to be able to share the data on that. Right now, it's a little bit of a faith-based thing, if you will.
Yeah, it's intuitive that there's benefits there. We just have to discover, you know, kind of quantify them. Kevin talks a lot to me about Industry 4.0 and, you know, Biopharma 4.0 for cell and gene therapy in particular. I wonder for you, Elliot, and then I'll ask Kevin to comment, what does good look like for you in the kind of short to medium term for the industry? We know that biopharma generally is a laggard on the adoption curve of technology for, I would say, some would say good reasons. You know, we're trying to make sure that no one gets hurt and we don't want to be out in front. But also, you find that a lot of those tools that have become standards, even in other regulated industries, like maybe energy or financial services or other things that could be adopted to good use in biopharma, are often not adopted for a very long time until after other industries. So what do you think is realistic in the short to medium term for us to think about from an Industry 4.0 perspective?
Yeah, I think, you know, for the my perspective is that for the companies that have been around a while, there's just a ton of legacy that kind of ties their hands in a way that allows them to really only invest incrementally. As a new entity, you know, we've had an opportunity and to rethink some of this. I can't say that we're without legacy. We've grown inorganically through acquiring a number of facilities that require significant, let's say, just investment in order to come up to what we consider to be the resilience standard, which is different than sort of building net new resilience facilities, which we're also doing. But there's so much to be learned from other sectors and certainly the tech sector in terms of how things like IoT and cloud are being used from cybersecurity perspective and how one secures the estate. There's a lot that's been done on the OT side of energy and other sort of pieces of critical infrastructure that translate directly to biopharma. So those are some of the places where we've been making maybe the most significant investments in both the new facilities, but also the established ones that we have acquired. You know, there's no shortage of opportunity. It's just you have to have the will to go do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Kev, I might direct this one at you just to ask, what's your view on why is it so, you know, particularly important for cell and gene therapy that we address this early in our life cycle as an industry and that we adopt digital from the very beginning?
It's one of the rare places where, you know, and Jason, as you've said on the podcast before, that the science has very much been proven and the manufacturing of the product is, you know, one of the largest challenges in growth and adoption and really getting these products to patients. And it's why digital as an enabler to these companies and therapeutics developers and the people who are helping them manufacture really as an accelerator is a key piece, because by starting there, it removes a huge barrier to scale. Right. It just becomes impossible, I think is probably the most direct term for it, to think that you could do a non-small cell lung treatment for 110,000 patients a year on a paper-based record and with all the manual review of those pieces. So, you know, as Elliot mentioned, you know, I think there's a lot of legacy in this space, and the early people who come in to develop these therapies bring some of that with them or invest into places that have it. But the earlier that we can remove the error-prone process of transferring information onto a paper record, the earlier we can build in feedback loops of what that data is saying in both real time and retrospectively. And the faster we can drive process improvement in a place where sort of the process is the product, the more enabling all of these things will be for the cell and gene space.
Makes sense to me. I mean, I'm a Luddite compared to you two gentlemen on this topic, but you know, sort of the idea that paper becomes the enemy of scale, it's kind of a barrier to, we know QA and QC processes at the end of a cell and gene therapy run are incredibly labor intensive and will ultimately be a bottleneck for any product at any scale above, you know, a couple of doses. It just stands to reason that, you know, it's a bottleneck we need to address now. Everyone hopes, patients hope, you know, sponsors, everyone is hopeful that we'll get to thousands of doses a month even. We're nowhere near that now. And Elliot, I wonder, what's your thought on how structured data, cloud solutions, advanced analytics can really help in this vein? You know, the status quo today, as Kevin said, is pretty much paper-based processes universally. You know, what are some key things we need to do to realize this scaled high throughput future in your view?
Yeah, I mean, where do you even start? It's sort of shocking to be an outsider to now be in this industry and see how much paper in 2022 or whatever. That's crazy. And given how important this is, but it's just a legacy to deal with. You know, philosophically, you know, we have a belief that at the end of the day, it's all about the data. It's about liquidity of data. And that, you know, the scientists who are industrializing the processes and coming up with a way to move it into the facilities from a tech transfer standpoint, like at the end of the day, they need to not constantly be moving between different disparate systems, copying, being able to do analysis that is based on the information coming off their instruments, and that there's a tight feedback loop, you know, to go from what they are seeing from the process development back to, you know, new experiments based on the insights they're getting from the data. That requires us to build out what, I guess, what we're terming sort of a scientific workbench for the process analytical development labs. It's all about, you know, what are the best in breed tools, but what are the things that we do to liberate the information between them and allow the analysis and the closed loop, you know, feedback of learning to go as quickly as possible. But it's more than that. It's also about having a common language for how you describe bioprocesses. It's sort of, how do you give scientists who are not necessarily digitally facile the tools not to make common mistakes? And then how do you learn from the body of work that has happened in the past in developing these methods and processes, so that not every project starts from scratch. Every new customer partner comes to us and says, "Hey, we'd like some help with this." We should say, "Hey, this looks 80% like something we've done before. Let's focus on the 20% that's different about your project." So I think there's a lot of acceleration in process and analytical development that can happen through digital means, as well as then the tech transfer into the facilities. Having it in a digital format where you can use something like batch to MML as a language to move it right from the pad lab into manufacturing execution system and shorten tech transfer times, we think is also going to be a big deal for us in order to shorten the turnover time, shorten the overall campaign that we're going to run on behalf of a customer and be able to serve more customers with the same footprint, the same number of scientists. So again, have we proven that with data to show just what that reduction is? Like, it's early days. We're starting to measure these things, but it's pretty clear, like, it can only get better from where the industry is right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit yet to pick. I think you're right about that. I mean, Kevin, you experienced this when you joined Tmunity firsthand and built their paperless manufacturing process. I would say that you're one of only a couple individuals in the world who's actually done this from scratch, and we're doing, you know, batch release with no paper involved, which is a epic feat in its own. I'd love to hear a little bit of your own kind of lived experience on, you know, what does it take to get this done internally? I know there's always some objections often from quality for good reason because, you know, we haven't done it that way before and we're not sure, you know, how does this get done in the real world?
The yeah, I mean the first thing and really the biggest sort of stake to put in the ground was to try to never get paper introduced. And so we talk about legacy processes that are running on them, and converting those from paper to digital is a huge uplift. In fact, there's talk in the industry of people who are building whole new facilities to transition their people between buildings to go from paper to digital. In our experience, it was to really show wins as early as possible in getting these systems into people's hands. And we actually started with our LIMS system for a certificate of analysis. And there's a story I've told a few people, which is we knew that actually the way the C of A report was being generated was wrong when it was initially published to production. And the sort of, you know, team working through that also knew, but our partners in quality were pretty convinced that it was set the right way. And so we built it the way we were requested to, but then in Sandbox, sitting next to it, had the version we believed to be correct, ran it the first way, came out wrong, and sort of everybody in our with our partners in quality and compliance were, you know, feeling vindicated in that this would never work. We went back to them to sort of say, we believe, you know, basically your select statement now against a bunch of database tables is incorrectly formatted. Can we show you the one we think is right? And when we handed them the correct one, the light bulb went on for all of those people. And they not only became a believer in digital, but they also really understood the power of that platform in standing in front of auditors or others sort of investigating what's going on there, because it was very much immutable at that point, right? There was no way to go stick a page into the middle of a batch or change things around and pre or post-date things. They were all real and justified. And that really spurred us forward in our adoption of our execution system and turning everything into unit operations as we went forward. And you know, the final benefit of all of this really became what we learned was the people who do CAR T development or people who build viral vector are genius level folks who really hold a lot of that process in the gray matter between their ears. And by digitizing each of those into an operation, you started to realize that, you know, it didn't devalue any of them. It just meant that people could actually take vacations. Or if you did have turnover in a facility, you could retrain somebody on a process. So it was very much a walk, crawl, run exercise, but it was trying to find a proof point of its reality as early as possible.
Yeah, I think from an N of one, we certainly probably can learn a lot from that. But I wonder where, Elliot, your view is on kind of where we are in this journey today. You know, what are the kinds of conversations you're having with potential partners or customers? Are they open to this idea? I know when we talk about this, oftentimes we get looked at like we're, you know, about to hop into our spaceship and fly to Mars or something. You know, I wonder, are we on the way, or we haven't really started the journey yet from your perspective?
I mean, I can't really speak to how other companies are doing it. I can tell you the interactions we've had with customers who are getting their hands on what we're building for them. There's been nothing but positive. Some even saying potentially transformative, but again, it's super early. So just a tremendous amount of internal work going on. So it's a lift, but like we don't get pushback from our internal stakeholders about it. Nobody wants to be on paper at the end of the day. I don't think anyone wants to fall back on that. It's more the other way, which is like, how quickly can you get us off our paper ways? And there, it's not quickly enough for my internal customers, if you will.
It's great to hear. You know, I think we anticipate some of the larger companies with embedded infrastructure that have that inertia inside of them already might be harder to bring around to this thinking. But you know, you hear about some of the largest already kind of trying to get out in front of it. So I suppose it's a bit of a mixed bag. But certainly the earlier preclinical and early stage clinical companies that we interact with are, because they don't have all that kind of emotional investment into the existing process, paper-based process, it's easier to show them the art of the possible, which sounds a little bit like what you guys spend your time doing.
I was just going to add, the other thing is it's really been great just working with sort of the best in breed vendors as well, who have, you know, off the shelf systems that we've been very careful about picking who we work with there. And they too have really had a hunger to work with, you know, an entity that's, you know, somewhat more progressive and going very fast and wants to do it all the right way. So that's been we have a very fruitful set of partnerships there pretty much across all the vendors we're working with. And that's been, you know, we can't be successful without them either, right? It's not, you know, that's a key piece of it.
Agreed 100%. We're not interested in reinventing the wheel. There's a lot of people that are doing pieces of this very well. So if we can tap into their expertise, that makes a ton of sense. Kevin, I don't know if you want to speak to that kind of ecosystem approach that you're leading on behalf of Ori and kind of our thinking around the how to pull the elements of the stack together that just help it make it easier for everyone to get it, take advantage of those best of breed technologies.
Yeah, and it's as easy as restating it, which is picking from best of breed in this space is a huge accelerator and really a opportunity to ease adoption as we go forward. So as Ori thinks through this as a, you know, problem statement or area to solve, it's really to minimize the total number of vendor partners that would need to be in the space while still getting to a minimally viable digital footprint and product. And so as we think through it for, you know, early stage pre-GMP, there's a few partners and tools that we would recommend in the space and we're continuing to work to pre-integrate with. And then as you move up the maturity complexity curve, the mids in both manufacturing as well as the actual therapy developers themselves get to the place of needing execution systems and the sort of unit operation based batch records for those. And then the larges and sort of some of the existing, I think what our hypothesis is that really moving all the way to automation platforms and making sure a set of manufacturing tools and a manufacturing platform is really ready to plug and play with a automation stack and work in sort of standard known SCADA, OPC, UA type communication protocols is a critical one to allow the adoption of some of those larger legacy players, because they all have environmental monitoring and they have building automation systems, and they have a lot of these things tied to their manufacturing platforms that are already running in automation platforms, and allowing that to creep into the center of clean rooms and cell cores probably is the way to start to expose them and introduce them to digital in the core of this space in a way that's comfortable for them.
It's interesting. I mean, I think that's this idea of a one-size-fits-all solution for all different stages and sizes just will never work. You know, we need to be flexible in the way we approach solving this problem. And, you know, to that end, Elliot, I'm curious, you know, you talked about sort of some of the partnerships that you're looking at across the ecosystem. Are you also potentially looking at developing your own bespoke solutions, you know, from the ground up, that where you don't see a best of breed partner potentially to work with to develop your own solutions to plug the gaps, I assume? Is that part of the strategy?
Yeah, no, 100%. We're very active with that. As we look at, so we somewhat uncreatively call the Resilience Digital Platform, we kind of bucket it. We look at it as what capabilities is that endowing our customers with, whether it's internal or external. And there's certain capabilities that are foundational and table stakes stuff. And there's certain things that are, you know, and those tend to be organized around how you operate your workflow and how do you observe things in the data. Next phase up is sort of like, what are the best in class capabilities? And for us, that tends to be things that are predictive and allow us to optimize activities. And then there's sort of next generation capabilities. And for those, that's really where we're talking about the scaling, the automation, and then sort of the customer engagement and delight. external customers in particular. So the more we get into the next generation, that it's really hard to find off-the-shelf product that meets our needs. Whereas for the foundational into best in class, we can often find partners, vendors that we work with, careful selection. So we do have a software development shop in-house on my team, which is product management, product design, software architecture, software engineering, quality, as you'd expect for software as well. But the focus is really on what are the biggest pain point for customers you can't get in commercial off-the-shelf product. And probably the biggest piece there is just what's the entire customer interface to us that's electronic. What's the equivalent of the AWS console where you can log in and interact with us, place an order, and see all the work that's being done. That's not really something you can just buy.
Yeah, it's not available off the shelf. And does that innovation extend? We hear a lot about kind of buzzwords like AI, machine learning, advanced analytics. We need to have a solid foundation for our data platform in a structured way so that we can actually derive information and insights from it with tools like these. How are you guys thinking at Resilience, thinking about advanced analytical tools? Because ultimately, everyone sort of says, well, big data is important, and data is important in and of itself. And I often say, maybe somewhat naively, that data isn't valuable. It's the information and insights that you can derive from it that are valuable. Just having more and more data that just exists out there in the world isn't necessarily providing a benefit. So, how are you guys thinking about advanced analytics to really try and make sense of all of this, the stuff we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, the way we think about it is that has to live in each piece of the business. That can't be in the digital team. Like, finance has to have its business analysts and data scientists and machine learning people, just like R&D does, just like manufacturing does. So our job, at least on my team for digital, is build the infrastructure that's sort of the best practices and sort of the data engineering and the data management and data protection and the tooling that enables the data scientists and analysts and machine learning experts through the company to do their work. That's our approach. And the folks closest to the business are the ones deciding, where they're going to take their analytics and their machine learning and how much of that is off the shelf models. If you're in MSAT, for example, we have folks who are doing, computational fluid dynamics. You don't have to build your own software for that. Like, that exists. You should use that to build digital twins of your processes. Absolutely. And we support that. Whereas in sort of earlier phase R&D, like, they actually have to build their own ML models to be predictive of certain characteristics they're looking for in the design, some of the engineering science they're doing. They're off, building their own data pipelines and machine learning models and things of that nature there. So there isn't like a one size fits all, and plus our company is pretty sprawling at this point. So I guess that's how we're thinking about it. It's very use case driven. It's very business driven. But we want the data to be available and the data fabric to move it around and the infrastructure that's common so that, people aren't reinventing that wheel.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. Kevin, maybe in our last few minutes with Elliot, you could just make a remark on how these kinds of tools fit into the overall ORI strategy. I mean, I think obviously making sense of these large data sets that we're going to have access to is a value for our potential partners, and love to hear more about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and I think Elliot actually hit on a really good point, which is the customer experience of tech transferring onto a manufacturing platform is probably one that doesn't get talked about enough, and how more elegant that can be as you move these things to digital processes. But to the sort of thought for ORI, and another thing that Elliot sort of alluded to, which is how do we classify, categorize, and standardize how we understand these data points going forward, which is a really critical part for ORI as we continue to develop, which is let's make these classifications and hierarchies and the categorization of these pieces standard and easily shared across partners and developers so that we can all start speaking more of a common language. And then for us to sort of the the same piece, which is, again, Elliot said, if you know that a CAR T process looks 80% like one that you've already run in your manufacturing platform before, it's a big uplift for somebody who's about to do that transfer. And how do we better understand those to, one, speed tech transfer onto our platform, but then also use those learnings as a feedback loop to current state and future state customers to make their outcomes, better, safer, more likely for success in a manufacturing run. So the two parts really are making sure our data is as standardized as it can be. It's understood and captured the same way every time it's run through. And then from a process perspective, to start to better understand how those operate based on cell type or therapeutic area, and work to use successes and learnings from each of those to feedback to the next set of customers to migrate onto the
I
platform.
mean, it just seems to me that there are massive opportunities for efficiencies in this whole process of, I mean, a 10-year or more process of developing a product. We feel like that we have the potential to cut 30% off that development cycle. If you can do it in 7 years, but now it's taking us 10, that saves a massive amount of money and brings the products to patients that much more quickly. Even if you look, Elliot, you talked to earlier about tech transfer and how painful that is. In a non-digital world, most often today, that can take 3 or maybe even 6 months to tech transfer between sites. And what a giant waste of time. You spend all that time on, paper-based SOPs and training the staff, and you've got the stack of paper you got to tick the boxes on. So I just, some of these things are fundamentally, very intuitive of, how this could save massive amounts of time and costs. I wanted to just ask you a question, Elliot, about, obviously the way I describe it, and maybe I'm not using the right words, would love to hear yours, is, resilience is really building a national network, a footprint of, multiple physical locations, through partnerships with organizations like Bluebird, and you've announced, I think, some partnerships with various other academic entities like Harvard or CHOP in Philly. There's going to be a national footprint of facilities doing different things. And how does digital, I mean, it just makes incredible sense. I mean, there's no other way to do it other than to have a fully digital platform. How does your work really power the resilience network and the future vision that you guys have for manufacturing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the audience and how familiar they are with sort of the world of cloud computing, let's say, but when you go to a hyperscale cloud provider, whether that's AWS or Microsoft or Google, there's a global network of data centers that provide services by the drink as a utility, so that you just pay for what you need and it scales up or down at, with the elasticity you want, and it's always there and always available. And we believe that that can exist and will exist in biomanufacturing, and that's what we're building with our global network of facilities. And the range of services is everything from lab scale through commercial scale and across all the advanced modalities. But it's not to say it's easy to do that, but the precursor to that has to be standardization in order to industrialize. Like today, this is an industry that's really bespoke and artisanal. It's almost the province of only the privileged few who can afford to invest in their own facilities, their own CMC people, and it's very costly, and it's, when you look at all the therapies that want to come to market, whether you're a Tmunity or a Bluebird or any of the upstarts who want to bring these things to market faster, why are they investing in the equivalent of data centers? Not even that. They're basically investing in the equivalent of writing their own microcode, developing their own silicon, developing their own servers. Like everything is being built by hand to do a task that is, should be given to a specialist who can do it in a scalable way. And so that is harder because it's a physical world, and biology is tough to tame. It isn't just a matter of like we're gonna run storage and compute and database and things like that across our data centers, but it can be done. But digital to us is sort of the key enabler for that standardization and scaling.
It's not all bits and bytes, but I think the argument that therapy developers are very good at a lot of things, discovering new molecules, testing them in the clinic, bringing them to patients. but maybe building out massive manufacturing facilities and the processes and people within that shouldn't be one of the things they have to worry about. You know, fully agree and appreciate that, and that this could be a specialist service that gets outsourced.
Yeah, and it's capacity constrained, and in an era where capital, especially even for biotech, is going to be more and more constrained, is that where you want to burn your capital? Developing all that from scratch. It's hard to do. It's not the best use of capital.
It's not a little bit of capital.
No.
We've seen $50 or $100 million spent on building a facility, and then you got to run it, and that's, you know, another massive undertaking. And yeah, it makes sense. And even though it hasn't been done before, it certainly makes sense. So in our final couple minutes together, I wonder, Elliot, if you'd be willing to pull out your crystal ball a bit and just give us a thought on where you see both national resilience and the cell and gene therapy industry in the kind of 3-year time frame and then maybe the 10-year time frame. What does good look like for you from your perspective, from your chair at National Resilience, but also as an industry participant?
Yeah, these things are always hard to say or do. I'd say our perspective is it's the earliest innings, earliest days for cell and gene. It's still the Wild West. Everyone has a different process for what they're trying to do. It's the furthest away from standardization and the biggest challenge, but it's also what most people came to resilience to do in the first place, is bring curative therapies to market faster for more of our partners and be an enabler in that way. So I think, you know, what we're certainly going to be focusing on is how much standardization can we bring, how much automation, mechanization, if you will, can we bring so that we are speeding up those timelines and we are creating a more reliable partner for how one makes these very difficult to make products. It's going to take time. We can see the pace of discovery. We can see the bottleneck in how those things reach market. Is it safe and effective in humans, but how do you make it? Turns out to be really challenging. So anything we can do to open the aperture for the physical production of these products at scale is a big help in unleashing the potential for cell and gene. But how long that will take is really anybody's guess.
Yeah, 100%. I guess because you operate in multiple verticals, vaccines and biologics might be further ahead, certainly, than we are in cell and gene. There's lessons to learn, but I would argue there's new problems that we have to think differently about. Just kind of translating the learnings from those other verticals, you know, won't quite cut it. We've tried that a little bit. We've dipped our toe into it, and we've managed to produce highly clinically effective but very expensive products that we can't make and can't bring to patients at scale, which, as you said, isn't really the goal.
No, absolutely. Getting the COGS down is a critical piece. The supply chain, the end-to-end routing, you know, to patients, and you know, there's a lot of complexity there, and an explosion of types of cell therapies, and as we move into not just cells but tissues, potential is amazing, but there's a ton of work to be done.
For sure. Kev, if I get a parting thought from you on kind of how you view Ori's role in the kind of short to medium term in trying to enable some of these things to happen.
It's no more complex than trying to get at least a piece of the manufacturing process and platform into more of a standardized, scalable place that has inline data capture and sensing going on to it, and is, you know, as Elliot mentioned, things like IoT and the security of these, is how can you make these, you know, devices, equipment, instruments, and platforms digitally native day zero, right? And really have them be prepared to work in a much more modern ecosystem. And it's very much the mission and the drive of what we're doing at Ori, is to ensure that those pieces in that platform are much more ready to operate in this type of space as we go forward.
Yeah, we're kind of trying to future-proof it so we can get it right and working with partners who think this way. So a great final set of thoughts from you, Elliot, and you, Kevin. Thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate you sharing your insights, and look forward to hopefully meeting again in three dimensions at some point soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for the invitation to chat, and looking forward to seeing you live as soon as possible.
Thank you for listening to the Ori Spotlight podcast. To keep up with the latest in cell and gene therapy and to follow us on our mission to manufacture brighter futures for patients, head to the show notes to follow us on social media or visit OriBiotech.com.